This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange.
We're going to bring back our jobs, and we're going to save our jobs, and people are going to have great jobs again.
We're going to create jobs in Pennsylvania and across America, especially in places that have been left out and left behind.
Jobs in the economy are always a top priority for voters during any election year. This year's presidential race has given a decidedly protectionist flavor to these issues, with a campaign discourse focused on wage stagnation, the loss of manufacturing jobs, and the unfair trading practices of other countries. After years of both political parties singing the praises of free trade in the global marketplace, the current nominees are instead promising to return manufacturing jobs with higher wages to the states, punish uncooperative companies, and take a hard line on any future trade negotiations. We'll discuss whether these campaign promises are realistic, given automation in the current global economic climate, and we'll discuss what the future of manufacturing holds for the United States and for New Hampshire. Today on The Exchange, it's presidential promises and manufacturing jobs. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have four guests joining me for the show this morning. With me in studio are Jim Roach. Jim is president of the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. And Jim, it's good to see you.
Thank you, Dean.
Bob Sanders. Bob is a reporter for the New Hampshire Business Review. Bob, it's good to see you, too.
Great to be here.
And joining me from Washington, D.C. is Andrew McGill. Andrew is senior associate editor at The Atlantic. And Andrew, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And on the phone is John Olson. He's president and CEO of Whelan Engineering. He joins us from the Connecticut plant of Whelan, which also has facilities in Charlestown, New Hampshire. And John, thanks for joining The Exchange.
Happy to do it.
Thank you. Gentlemen, let's start with a look at the national picture on manufacturing. And Andrew, let me turn to you first, since you've done a lot of reporting on this topic. How would you characterize the current state of U.S. manufacturing?
Well, in some ways, it's doing perfectly well. If you look at the real output of American manufacturing over the past 20 or 30 years, it's steadily, on the average, gone up. There's a brief dip at some recessions, but you know we're higher now than pretty much we've ever been before in actual output. But in terms of employees, this is where you kind of see the negative picture we're hearing on the campaign trail. We really hit our peak employment in the manufacturing sector back just before 1980, and since then we've kind of steadily trended downwards. You know, back in the late 70s, essentially, we had around 20 million manufacturing employees, and now we're down to about 12. And that, I think, is kind of driving the pain that Donald Trump especially is bringing up in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New Hampshire.
And those kinds of places are obviously known for steel manufacturing, other kinds of sort of heavy industry, correct?
Sure. Yeah. No. I mean, I used to work in Pittsburgh, and Donald Trump has been there and openly said, you know, we're going to bring steel back. It's really the kind of the Rust Belt cities and towns and regions that are having this kind of manufacturing loss over the past 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a bit later about whether those jobs can be restored or not. But Bob, let me turn to you a little bit. I'm interested in your thoughts. You obviously also can give us a little bit of the New Hampshire context.
Well, in New Hampshire, I looked at the latest stats, and out of our private non-farm employment, manufacturing is like out of 672,000, we're at 66,000, which is like 9% roughly. But that's total of employment of manufacturing workers. You're really of those that are actually workers, you know, is 44,000. So we're talking like about 6%. And I think actually the union membership is higher than the number of manufacturing workers. That's how low it is. And it's going down. It's down by about a couple of thousand from last year. So, but what's interesting is the wages are going up. And that seems to indicate that what's happening is that we don't need jobs. We need workers. The reason the number of jobs are going down is because we can't find workers to fill the positions, and That's I think, the major story in New Hampshire.
And we're going to explore a little bit about why that's a problem. And, Jim, let me turn to you. What are you hearing from members of your association on the state of manufacturing nationally, but also certainly in New Hampshire?
Well, notwithstanding what your other guests have said, I just want to point out that the latest data that I have shows 67,000 people working in manufacturing, which is the third largest employment base in the private sector behind retail, trade, and healthcare. And I would argue that those jobs are really wealth-creating jobs, unlike, for example, retail trade, which takes dollars that are already circulating in the economy and uses them differently. Manufacturing generates wealth, provides exports, brings new dollars into the state's economy. The National Association of Manufacturers has an affiliate called the Manufacturing Alliance for Productivity and Innovation, and they performed a study recently, and they measure the real impact of manufacturing nationally as being 34% of gross domestic product. So that would include not just manufacturing itself, but the upstream and the downstream jobs and activity that goes into manufacturing. You know, the engineers and the accountants and the advertisers and the trucking and the railroads that take manufactured products and the ships to market. We did a study. Actually, we commissioned a study a few years back by the Center for Public Policy Studies, and that study indicated for every 100 jobs in manufacturing, it supports an additional 138 jobs in New Hampshire. So, total of 238 jobs in the state. So my point is that manufacturing may have declined over the decades, but it remains, in my view, the most important economic sector
pretty
in New Hampshire, notwithstanding other important sectors. You know, tourism is very important to the state's economy, healthcare, financial services, business services. But manufacturing, I think my board would agree, drives New Hampshire's economy in a way that no other sector does. How manufacturers are doing varies by company. Those that are exporting, for example, to China or have business relationships with China may have seen a bit of a drag on their businesses. China's economy decelerates. The Eurozone itself is somewhat sluggish. So it really depends on the kind of manufacturing that's taking place and where their customer base is. Generally speaking, I think manufacturing is doing at least as well as it was prior to the Great Recession. But again, it depends on what company you're talking about.
John Olson, my understanding is you've been with Whelan for over 50 years, I believe. So you can give us a good kind of institutional memory on this. What's your sense of where manufacturing is for you now, you know, perhaps versus or the previous few decades?
Well, we are bucking the trade, the trend rather, of manufacturing, which in this country is diminishing. We do not have the manufacturing segment does not have the support of government the way I feel they should. Considering that we contribute, like in New Hampshire, a huge amount of taxes, good-paying jobs, and so forth, we're not seeing leadership in the crisis on energy, which is drastically going to affect manufacturing in New Hampshire, because we've done nothing to relieve the pressure that manufacturers feel from the most expensive energy in the United States.
So John, let me ask you, do you feel that the kind of the demand for your products, and you should probably describe for our listeners what you produce. My understanding is you have something like 1,100 employees, but is your sense that the demand for the products are there, but you're not getting the help you need? Is that right?
We have the demand for our products, but we have 14 competitors. Every one of our we manufacture emergency warning signals, right, which go on police cars, fire trucks, ambulances. We make aircraft exterior lighting, and so forth. We are the only true manufacturer in the United States. All of our competition either is made in China or component parts are made in China, and some final assembly work is done in the U.S. We manufacture all of our components basically in Charlestown. So we're fighting quite a bit of a battle, but we're doing all right, and we've been in business. This is our 60th year.
Andrew, I'm going to turn back to you in a moment, but first let's take a listen to what Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has to say about what he believes is an international trade war.
Some people have said that my policies on trade will lead to a trade war. Well, I guess when you think about it, we're already in one. We're losing $500 billion a year to China. We're losing billions and billions to Japan and Vietnam and India. And Mexico is beating us both at the border, and they're beating us in trade. So when you say war, they're in a war, we're not in a war, because they're beating us so badly.
That is Donald Trump, actually in an online campaign advertisement for why he believes the country is currently in the midst of an international trade war. And I want to tell our listeners, we're talking about manufacturing and trade today in the United States and New Hampshire. We're going to talk about campaign promises as well. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. And Andrew McGill, let me turn back to you to get your thoughts about the impact of globalization and these trade agreements on manufacturing, as John suggested, and also as we just heard from Donald Trump.
Well, there's no doubt that it's been huge. When you have trade pacts that encourage Americans to buy goods abroad without tariff protections, with reduced fees essentially, you're going to see more manufacturing abroad. And I think that there's little doubt that NAFTA and CAFTA and the kind of slew of trade agreements that America signed in the 90s and beyond have had some effect on making it cheaper to produce goods abroad that previously were produced in the United States. The problem is that trade and manufacturing historically has always moved to where it's cheapest to produce goods. And you saw this in America before you saw it abroad. You saw the flight of factories from the industrial Northeast to the American South long before they were moving to Japan and China. The issue with trade internationally these days, these factors have been going on for quite some time. And arguably, this is something that America kind of settled in on 2 decades ago. We've seen the effects, but Donald Trump appears to kind of be bringing it back up. I mean, to a large extent, NAFTA is a settled issue. We're not going to see manufacturing centers move back from China now that they're abroad. And really, it's done more to kind of shift what America does manufacture these days than anything else. We're seeing much higher tech in manufacturing in America. The average manufacturer, an average manufacturing employee is vastly different than they were 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And Bob, let me turn to you and get your thoughts on the issues that have been raised by John and Andrew about trade and globalization. Bob?
Well, I'm thinking of GT Advanced Technology, which it did very well when it was building the furnaces to produce solar cells and shipping that to China. The Chinese would make the solar cells, and then they would ship it back to us. They were making a lot more per margin than the Chinese were. And they were doing very well. What they foundered is when they started working for Apple and started making stuff for the United States. So trade can go both ways. We've picked up our trade gone up about 8% in the last year. And New Hampshire has helped New Hampshire ride the recession. While we had the fastest growing increase in trade during that time, and it's kept up. And while we went up 8%, the United States has gone down. So we've been taking advantage of this trade.
Yeah, Jim?
Well, I would just say that trade is incredibly important to New Hampshire's economy, and many of my members, many BIA members, and many businesses throughout the state rely on trade. And so it's not a simple task to renegotiate trade agreements or to establish tariffs or whatnot. There are a lot of unintended consequences that result from messing around with trade wars. Some examples of companies that trade around the world are Hypertherm in the Upper Valley, one of the state's most prominent successful companies. I believe most of their business is done outside the United States. Medtronic over in the Seacoast is another company that engages in trade throughout the world. Even Sealite, a smaller company that makes navigation buoys in Tilton, sells its products around the world. So these are companies right here in New Hampshire that employ collectively thousands of New Hampshire residents with some of the best paying jobs in the state. So, negotiating trade and talking about putting up tariffs is all well and good, but there are a lot of unintended consequences that may adversely impact New Hampshire businesses and our economy.
In the interest of equal time here. Let's listen to Hillary Clinton talking about her own views on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and trade in a speech in Michigan last week.
My message to every worker in Michigan and across America is this. I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I oppose it now. I'll oppose it after the election, and I'll oppose it as president.
That is Hillary Clinton in a speech last week talking about her opposition on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And Andrew McGill, this is something that Hillary Clinton has got some criticism for ostensibly changing her her position.
Sure. I mean, you know, in her speech just right then, you know, she didn't mention that she opposed it before. When she was Secretary of State, granted, you know, she works for the administration. Her job is to help further its goals. She called the TPP, you know, and trade pacts like it, the gold standard for this kind of trade agreement. You know, and certainly the tenor of this campaign in the primary against Bernie Sanders, I think, has brought this issue more to a head and perhaps changed, you know, the former Secretary of State's opinion on the matter. But, you know, certainly the idea of a trade pact is sort of on shaky ground right now, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that is traditionally a staple of American policy. We have always in America advanced free trade, generally speaking, in the modern era at least, with the idea that it helps American businesses and it helps the world businesses. But because of the political climate we have right now where jobs are at the forefront, where the idea of offshoring immigration is top of the voters' minds, Clinton is trying to, I think, weave between two camps here, and the TPP, it appears, has become a little bit of a whipping boy for both parties at this point.
Mm-hmm. And John, you talked earlier about having multiple foreign competitors. Do you typically pay close attention to these kinds of trade deals?
Yes. But
go ahead.
You know, we could better compete on a global environment if we didn't have so many onerous, complicated, and expensive government at all level regulations. And when we get involved in doing business with the various government agencies with what I consider unessential rules and regulations, I now know why my competitors simply pick up the phone, call ding ding dong in China and say, make me 10,000 and send them over. It's a lot easier than going through all of the baloney that our governments have put in front of manufacturing to discourage it. It's almost like the governments at all level have made a decision that they do not want manufacturing in their backyard anymore.
So for you, John, the sort of domestic regulation here in the States is almost as problematic as the actual trade agreements themselves, sounds like.
That's probably more of a problem.
Yeah, Bob, real quick, let me get your thoughts on this issue of regulation in New Hampshire. We have to go to a break shortly, but let's get you started.
Well, the part of the trade deals is that they're trying to up the regulation in other countries, so to equal it out. In other words, we have to deal with environmental regulations because, you know, we're supposedly concerned about our environment. And China, they don't have to do that. So there's an unequal. The same thing with labor regulations. All these regulations that we have, other countries don't. That's why they like to go there. Supposedly the protections in these trade deals that the Bernie Sanders want to get in would up that and make it more equal.
We have to take a quick break here, but we got lots more to talk about on campaigns, campaign promises, and manufacturing in New Hampshire and the United States. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about campaign promises, New Hampshire manufacturing jobs, and the 21st century workforce. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. And gentlemen, let's pick up where we left off talking about trade and jobs. And I wanted to go to you, Jim Roach, to talk a little bit about those issues and also skilled workers as well.
Well, as we chatted briefly about during the break, the top concerns of manufacturers in New Hampshire right now are the availability of skilled labor. You know, we have an aging population. I think most of us are aware that, you know, at least half of the young people that graduate from our high schools and colleges leave the state. And so that's a challenge combined with aging demographics, where at this point, 59% of manufacturing workers are age 45 or older, and the number of workers in that segment below that is dropping pretty dramatically. So this is a bit of a tsunami facing manufacturers, on top of the lack of skilled and available workers, particularly younger workers, to replace workers that are aging out of the workforce. Is, as John Olson alluded to, the high cost of electrical energy. You know, we have
it's a big issue here in New Hampshire.
Our rates here in New Hampshire and New England are 60% higher. They are consistently 60% higher than the national average. And so when you have manufacturers in New Hampshire, and many of them have multiple facilities around the country or around the globe, they look at a lack of an available and skilled workforce and very high energy costs, and they start looking at their options outside of New Hampshire. And that has real long-term economic implications for New Hampshire's health going forward.
And Andrew, let me turn to you and just talk a little bit about kind of the changing nature of the skill set for these jobs. You know, we talk about there now being kind of smaller firms with higher wages, but it's a different type of worker that people are looking for now.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when you think back to the 60s and 70s and perhaps even the early 80s, you know, 3/4 of manufacturing workers didn't have schooling past high school. And almost a third hadn't graduated from high school at all. And that really isn't something that you see today. You know, in 2014, I think more than half the employees in factory jobs had some amount of post-secondary schooling. Now, that doesn't mean college necessarily. That means either a two-year school or a certificate program. But really, you're seeing kind of the end of the era of kind of a mass low-skill sector where mostly anyone who had basic schooling could come in and make a living. And particularly since unions were more prevalent back 30, 40 years ago, they could have a good wage while they did it. These days, the jobs are much more highly skilled. They require to be able to use computers and high math skills. And really, it's a much more demanding workplace and requires more education. And that's the kind of worker that it appears manufacturing centers are looking for.
Bob, your thoughts on this? You wanted to get in.
Yeah, I think the one thing that we're seeing is that this shortage of workers in New Hampshire is absolutely crucial. It's the main thing manufacturers have been talking about, everybody that I've talked to. I mean, you have wages going up, which shows that's been the big thing. It's not been jobs; it's been wages. And in New Hampshire, they've gone up from $19.64 an hour for a factory worker to $21.04 in a year. That's $1.50 raise in a year. That's pretty good. But the problem is you need education to get these jobs. It's not like if your factory says, well, we're working at McDonald's. We have that factory next door. I could get a job there. No, they can't. And that's the problem. And we need skilled workers. And the problem is a lot of them are going to Massachusetts. If there's a giant sucking, sound, it's coming from Massachusetts, sucking all our high-skilled workers down there. And if anybody's going to build a wall, maybe it should be on the Massachusetts border to keep our workers in.
And, John, I know that your company, from reading about it, uses robotics. How has kind of the skill set changed for your workers over the decades?
Variety of skill requirements from hand assembly to very sophisticated robotic programmers and operators. But I would say that 50% of our employees have to have an advanced amount of education to work in our type of work. That doesn't necessarily mean 4 years of college, but at least be able to understand the basics of computer programming and operation, as well as mechanicals.
Jim, you want to jump in?
Well, in addition to the or in response to the shortage of skilled labor, there are a number of companies throughout the state that have sort of taken the bull by the horns themselves and introduced both high school students to the shop floor and post-secondary students that are engaged in post-secondary education, community college, college work, and Wayland Engineering is a great example. They have a program called Little League of Manufacturing. They work with a number of high schools in the area to bring high school kids into Wayland Engineering to see what's made, to shadow folks on the shop floor for high school credit. And likewise, Hitchster Manufacturing, Hypotherm, New England Wire Technologies, New Hampshire Ball Bearings, BA Systems, Graphicax. There are more and more companies that are embracing the idea of bringing high school kids into their places of business to expose them to what's being made there. A lot of kids and their parents and guidance counselors, unfortunately, operate on the old paradigm that manufacturing is dirty and unsafe. Right. And it couldn't be further from the truth. Today's manufacturer is clean, safe, outstanding career opportunities for kids. And you don't need a four-year engineering degree. Obviously, those jobs are available, but there are outstanding, beyond livable wage opportunities in manufacturing. So more and more manufacturers in New Hampshire are taking the initiative and introducing what's available right in the backyards of many young people and exposing them to manufacturing careers, which is really critical in the state if we hope to preserve the strong manufacturing sector going forward.
Mm-hmm. And gentlemen, let's go to the phones, and we have Peter in Derry. Peter, welcome to the exchange.
Good morning. I spent 34 years in the textile industry, and there used to be a tremendous, tremendous textile industry here in New England. What happened, as you pointed out before, is that the jobs moved south, then they moved to Puerto Rico and Mexico, and finally over to the Far East. If we wanted to bring that back, A, we'd have to, there are no people that know how to sew anymore. B, all the sewing machines exported with the jobs to those countries. So we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the people, and we don't have the people that are willing to take wages that have to be low enough to be competitive, or else you would end up paying a lot more for a garment at a store in the mall to pay the wages to rebuild the infrastructure to make the garments. The high-tech industry is one that may have had some resilience to it, but those jobs are few and far between.
And Peter, thanks for that call. And Bob, I'm going to go to you in a moment, but I want to let our listeners know we're talking about manufacturing jobs and the 21st century workforce in the United States. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. I have four guests with me today. Bob Sanders, he's a reporter at the New Hampshire Business Review. Jim Roach, who's a president of the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association. John Olson, who is president and CEO of Wheeland Engineering in Charlestown. And Andrew McGill, who's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. And Bob, let me get your thoughts to Peter's comments from Derry.
Well, I work at a textile mill, or what was a textile mill, Amascot Mills. And I work for a communication company. Downstairs is Dyne, which is an advanced internet company. And most of the offices are filled with jobs that have some kind of technology involved in it. The mills are filled, but they're filled with different workers, fewer and high skilled. All the mills along the – and colleges and things like that. This is what's happening with the – would you want – Would somebody really want to empty those mills out and put textile workers in there now? Or are we moving into an economy where there are higher skills, better pay, but maybe not as many jobs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim, real quick.
Well, just that I think, getting commodity manufacturing back to New Hampshire or beyond what we have today is probably not going to happen, and I'm not sure that it should happen. The kind of manufacturing that we want in New Hampshire, we want jobs that require higher skills that pay very good wages. And so, as it's interesting to me, as citizens, we want the lowest prices that we can get for our electronic devices and clothing and everything else. And that's what drives a lot of trade deals. Businesses are looking for where they can manufacture things and source things at the lowest possible cost. And so, as consumers, we need to recognize that trade is very important to the things that we have around us in our lives. But with regard to manufacturing in New Hampshire, I'm not sure we want a lot of low-paying commodity manufacturing jobs. I think we want the kind of jobs that we have right now that require higher skills and pay outstanding wages.
And Peter, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones. We have Chris joining us from Nashua. Chris, welcome to the exchange.
Hi, thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
I am a consultant for a company that consults to other consulting companies, so high-tech, management consulting and so on. And I can tell you firsthand, I see this, John Edwards Two Americas thing firsthand. I drive past, all kinds of places where there's very high unemployment, and I am going into these businesses that are, they have six-figure jobs just wanting, and they're everywhere. And so, which brings me to my point, America does not seem to have an industrial educational policy. We essentially, with the exception of a few BOTEC programs and the college track, we essentially pat high school graduates on the back and say, good luck, figure it out from here, and, hope everything works out. And I look at India, I look at Germany as examples, very successful examples. I mean, India produces bumper crops of engineers and doctors, and, of course, they fill entire subdivisions. I'm driving past one of them right now here in Nashua with engineers and doctors. And so, and Germany has a very successful apprenticeship program, which is the foundation of their industrialized economy. It's why they lead Europe. And it kills me that here in this country, we decide that taxes, low taxes, for what one of your guests was saying before, is really, what it's all about. We want to have low taxes, but business expects our high schools and colleges producing the skills that they need on demand, and yet they don't want to support it.
Chris, thanks for that call. Andrew, let me turn to you on that and get your thoughts on Chris's comments.
No, certainly. I mean, when you look at a place like Germany, which has, an exceptional program that helps students pursue different tracks for their education, it sure looks a lot different than what we have here. And I think for a good period of time, the four-year college education was the primary goal of every secondary school in America, or at least, that was the thing that they wanted to have as their badge of honor, sending kids on to a four-year college. And you're correct in that we have kind of a scattershot approach to VOTEC education here in America, and it's very much at a regional level. It might be a county school. It might be a collection of counties that have a combined school. It might even be a district that just has a partnership with a local business. We certainly don't have a national system to train students for the kind of medium-level, medium-wage jobs, but still education-intensive jobs that our manufacturing sector appears to need.
Chris, thanks for that call. And Jim, I wanted to get you to jump in here specifically on the issue of taxes and sort of the tax environment that we've been talking about.
Well, we do have high corporate income taxes, and of course we have the unique business enterprise tax, which a lot of businesses just think is another way to collect an income tax only businesses are paying. It's modest. Both of those taxes, fortunately, are going down modestly in the coming months, which is a good thing. With regard to, the complete picture, we don't have a sales tax, and that's important for businesses. Not having an income tax is important for those that run businesses. But taxes are one of many factors, many inputs for manufacturing. And as I mentioned earlier, the availability of skilled labor, especially for these higher level positions in manufacturing that we have in New Hampshire, is critically important, probably more important than the tax burden. And, of course, manufacturers use a lot of electrical energy and natural gas, and so the high cost of energy is hugely important as well. I would note, Dean, I think you're with regard to the training, the availability of skilled workers, there is a pretty impressive initiative underway called 65 by 25. There are probably two dozen different groups in New Hampshire, the university system and the community college system and organizations like STEAM Ahead and the New Hampshire Scholars Initiative and others that are focused on getting 65% of New Hampshire's working age adults, 24 to 65, to possess by the year 2025, hence the name 65 by 25, a meaningful post-secondary credential or degree that's useful to employers in the economy in the year 2025. Right now we're at about 50%. So we have a ways to go, but there are a lot of public and private and nonprofit organizations, as well as the Business and Industry Association and individual businesses that are focused on this goal. So, all is not lost. There are a lot of attention being paid to upping the skills of the workers that are available in New Hampshire.
And John Olson, we had an email from Nancy. And Nancy asked if you could give examples. You've mentioned onerous or unnecessary regulations that have been problematic for your business. And she's curious to know sort of which ones are most problematic for you.
Well, we're constantly being scrutinized by the DES and filling out forms over and over and over again because we use a certain number of chemicals in our business for potting and so forth. And it just is one add up, and then the labor rules and regulations are onerous to the manufacturer, and it just is one heaping bunch of rules and regulations that keep coming up, and it seems like the government likes to enforce them to keep a certain number of government employees on the payroll to enforce them.
So, sounds like environmental, labor, et cetera, all problematic for you.
Yeah. Some of them are practical, but some of them make no sense at all, at least to me. That doesn't mean it doesn't to somebody else, but to me. And I've been in this business 60 years.
Right. Folks, let's go back to the phones, and we have Anthony joining us in Keene. Anthony, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning. I love the conversation. I work with a staffing agency down in Keene, and it's the TPI staffing group. We operate up and down the 91 corridor. And I'm very curious to hear opinions on the role of automation on the cultivation of the next generation of workforce. I think the gentleman have hit the nail on the head in saying that the New Hampshire advantage is certainly gone. And sort of to backfill that draw for employers to enter into the state, we've got to really offer a viable long-term solution to their workforce. And I'm really wondering what the gentlemen feel about how automation has affected negatively that cultivation.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, thanks for that call. Let me go to you first, Bob.
Well, it is true. We are really competing for labor. And it is really tough. I mean, we have some really great schools in New Hampshire, but they have some very good schools down in Massachusetts, too. We don't have anything like MIT or Harvard up in New Hampshire. And also, it's the wages. And it used to be called, is economy stupid? I would say now it's the wages stupid. It's not the jobs. And we have 2.9% unemployment, and it just went up. I mean, that's how low our unemployment is. And the wages are higher down in Massachusetts. The minimum wage is higher, and the whole wage structure is higher. We're talking a differential of on the low end, at least $3 an hour. There's no way that taxes are going to make up for that. Our low taxes aren't $3 an hour. So we're losing people, even when we train them. If we train them up here, sometimes we're losing it. Get more money down there.
I have to jump in. We have to take one more break. But coming up, we're going to talk more about campaign promises and manufacturing jobs in New Hampshire. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, how feasible are the candidates' promises to create manufacturing jobs, and how will it play out with New Hampshire's aging and older workforce? Let's hear from you. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. I have four guests with me for the remainder of the show. I have Andrew McGill, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. I have John Olson, President and CEO of Wheeling Engineering in Charlestown. We have Jim Roach, president of the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association, and Bob Sanders, reporter for the New Hampshire Business Review. And Andrew, let me pick up with you. I think you've done some writing about automation, so I'm interested in getting your thoughts on Anthony's comments before the break.
Yeah, no, this is something I think about quite a bit because, you know, over the past three decades, we've seen the massive influx of automation into our manufacturing landscape. And really, when you think about it, 100 years from now, where are we going to be in terms of automation? It's conceivable that we will have robots and other technologies that will take care of the majority of manufacturing. And what really happens then when we don't need more than a person or two to mind our largely, you know, robot-driven factories? Now, we certainly aren't at that point yet, but when you look at the average factory size, it's dropped precipitously from kind of its peaks in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So we're already seeing a pattern of smaller factories with more robots, fewer humans, but producing more things. And I think that if we're going to rely on manufacturing to be a base of employment, and especially kind of medium to high skilled employment, we have to think about what role do we really want it to play once we have very sophisticated robots.
Mm-hmm. And gentlemen, we've got a lot
could
of people trying to.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
in?
John, you can jump in real quick. Sure. Go ahead.
I want to defend New Hampshire.
Okay.
I'm in a unique position. We have a company which we started in Connecticut, and then 30 years ago opened up our New Hampshire facility, which is now much, much, much larger. New Hampshire has a tremendous advantage for our employees when we transfer them up there. And I hope you people don't lose track of those advantages. No income tax and no sales tax is a huge amount of money that stays in people's pockets if they earn a decent wage, and we pay a decent wage. Most good companies do.
Yeah, and this is something that Jim had mentioned earlier in terms of the business climate. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a lot of people trying to get in on the conversation here. So let's go to Gary in Concord. Gary, welcome to the exchange. Gary?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on.
I just wanted to make a comment. John had talked about the government and the bureaucracies and making it difficult to do business here. I've dealt with manufacturing for about 17 years in the state of New Hampshire. GT Solar was one of our biggest accounts at about 800,000. I also deal with Hypotherm. GT was moved to Shanghai, China, a few years back. About 350 people lost their jobs, but also affected the economy, and everybody else has dealt with them. This makes it difficult to ship product from New Hampshire, from Manchester, New Hampshire, Shanghai. So wanted to make that comment and also make another comment that over the last 20 years, manufacturing, as the pie has shrunk incredibly. You can make calls all over New Hampshire, and there's no lumber mills left. There's probably two paper mills left, and there's very few high-tech jobs in the state of New Hampshire. Most of those original equipment manufacturers have gone down south or have gone overseas, and I'll take that comment off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate you calling in. Jim, let me go to you on this.
There's no question that manufacturing employment and the impact on the economy has declined over the decades. As Andrew mentioned, the manufacturing employment peaked in 1979. But the fact remains that just in terms of employment, it's the third largest employer in New Hampshire with 67,000 people. And as I alluded to earlier, it has the biggest economic impact on the state. So the strategy going forward ought to be to make this climate as helpful and beneficial to manufacturers as we can, so we preserve the jobs that we do have. I would also comment that there's no question, especially given the unavailability or the challenge it is to get particularly younger skilled workers into manufacturers, that they've invested heavily in equipment and technology, including robotics. So that simply, I think, points up the need for higher level skills than manufacturing of old. And as I have said repeatedly, these higher level skills result in jobs that are exceptionally well paying.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, we've mentioned China and Chinese imports several times. And according to the Wall Street Journal, New Hampshire is actually among the states hardest hit by Chinese imports. And if you go to nhpr.org, there's a link to an interactive map illustrating this on the website. So check it out if this topic interests you. Gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. And we have Don calling us from Northfield. Don, welcome to the exchange.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My comment, I guess, and might be a question, I was actually listening to a video this morning where one of our presidential candidates was talking to a number of CEOs, and she posed the question, if you could grow your business over the next 5 to 10 years and provide better conditions, just make your workers happy, that whole thing, and it would cost you one penny of your stock price, would you do it? And unanimously, all of the CEOs in that little gathering said, no, we would not. How can you grow businesses in a climate where we're totally beholden to profit and not growing the business?
That's a good question. John, you're a CEO. Let me turn to you for that question.
Well, fortunately, we are a family-owned business. And when I became president 40-plus years ago, I was told to run the business in the best interest of the customer and the employee. And if I did that well, the family would be happy. And maybe we need more of that.
Bob, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think that I find that hard to believe that most CEOs would
say no.
Would say no. I wasn't there, so, and I don't know about this, but I would think that most CEOs would think that if they can keep their workers happy, they will keep their workers. And in this environment, keeping their workers is really key. Maybe they don't care about their workers overseas so much. That's another story. But in the keep people here when skills and the high level and high skill set is necessary and people are hard to find and unemployment is so low, I just kind of find that they don't have much choice if they want to compete.
Mm-hmm. I don't get that too.
Yeah, go ahead.
The business leaders with whom I'm familiar throughout the state recognize that their top asset are their employees, especially in this climate, but even before this climate. They will do everything they can to accommodate the needs and the interests of their hardworking employees. So I kind of find that hard to believe too, that CEOs would not invest a penny of their stock price in their employees.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the migration of workers. And Sarah from Concord emailed us, and she said, my understanding is that New Hampshire no longer enjoys the same level of in-migration of talented workers that we enjoyed in the 1970s. She also mentioned she was disappointed to hear the comment by one of our panelists about the Chinese employer. And she wants to know, what does your panel have to say about the role of migration and immigration, considering Mr. Sanders' point that we have jobs, but we need workers? Let me turn to you first, Andrew, just more broadly, this issue of migration of workers. And then, John, I want to ask you a more specific question. So, Andrew.
No, certainly. Migration's always been very important in moving workers domestically, certainly. You can think of some of the great booms industrially have been driven by migration. You know, the growth of Detroit, to some degree the growth of the Northeast, all is driven by folks moving from other parts of the country to take up work. And also from outside the country, you know, a surge of immigration built to some degree our linkages to the West. So, you know, there's been literature out there and studies that talk about how this actually is a positive force for good for income equality as well. When you have the ability to move for work and you have the opportunity to find better wages and better opportunities elsewhere in the country, that kind of evens out to some degree wage disparities nationally. In terms of New Hampshire's situation, I can't speak on that particularly. But,
sure.
You know, the brain drain is a symptom everywhere in cities that formerly had large manufacturing bases. And I'm just thinking back again to Pittsburgh that had for years a tremendous brain drain of folks being educated in the area and then leaving after economic opportunities dried up. And, you know, reversing that for a city and for a region is certainly a big challenge.
Yeah. And, John, more specifically, I think Sarah was referring to your earlier comment about a specific Chinese employer. But let me ask you more generally, isn't it possible here that China has become sort of a convenient villain for American manufacturing, or is this really a genuine problem?
Oh, I think it's become very easy, especially for the small and electronic style of product. And they have no regard for us. For instance, let me tell you this. A lot of people don't realize. We have many, many patents on the designs that we make and the products that we make. offshore. They build an exact copy with our name on it and send it over here. We get them here for repair. I made a mistake. I called the patent office in Washington and told them about this problem and asked them to take care of it. And they said, oh, we don't do anything about that. That's your problem. So we don't have any protection on the patents that we own from offshore manufacturers.
Bob, you want to jump in?
Yeah, that's the kind of things that some people would like to put in the trade agreements. They're not anti-trade, but they're trying to basically have the law apply equally across borders. I want to just touch on the migration thing because you said you didn't know what was going on in New Hampshire. Well, nearly one in five workers in New Hampshire commute out of the state, and that's the highest percentage except for Washington, D.C. in the country. So, again, we have a lot of people going in, especially to Massachusetts, and that's a big problem. And we have some in-migration, of course, but it doesn't nearly make up for that.
Let's go back to the phones, and we have Tom calling us from Wyndham. Tom, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
Great discussion.
Great, thank you.
You talked a lot, I think it was yesterday on your program, about all politics is local.
Mm-hmm.
The manufacturer you have on your program, first thing he said is energy costs.
Right.
He's had two major political things about pipeline running through southern New Hampshire and about the Northern Pass, which, you know, a huge public outcry against. But these don't really help New Hampshire, as far as I can tell. The gas is going to Massachusetts. The electricity is going to Connecticut. What projects should we be promoting to help this manufacturer and others scale back our energy costs?
Great question. Jim, let me go to you to get kind of the broad overview.
Well, let me first say that the BIA is neutral on these massive energy infrastructure projects, but I think it's incorrect to say that if they do see the light of day and are put in place that New Hampshire won't benefit. The fact of the matter is that we're on a regional six-state grid. So any new energy flowing into the region will add more supply. And those of us that took Economics 101 know that increased supply should lower the cost of energy. And that is the thinking behind these energy projects. They will go to power natural gas fire generators, which are increasingly the source of electrical energy in New Hampshire. They will go to that the natural gas will result in businesses being able to access natural gas for their manufacturing processes. Those that use that in the manufacturing process at a lower cost, they will go to the regional grid that supplies electricity for all of us when we go home and turn the lights on or turn the AC on or whatnot. And so I think it's incorrect to say that these projects in New Hampshire and elsewhere throughout the region won't positively impact New Hampshire. They absolutely will because we're on a regional grid, a six-state grid.
Andrew, I want to bring you back into the conversation. We're sort of winding down here, but I want to kind of bring it back to the bigger picture of, you know, these promises that Clinton and Trump are making on trade. And, you know, if people are interested, we did a show on Tuesday about presidential power and whether or not presidents can really deliver on their promises. And you can find that at NHPR.org on the Exchange page. But let me ask you, you've been following these candidates pretty closely. You know, can they really deliver on these sort of promises they're making about manufacturing?
Well, it really depends on the promise. And I think any economist would say that promising that you're going to bring coal back to Pennsylvania, steel back to the Northeast, is probably not going to be able to deliver on that. And that's kind of been what Trump says at rallies. The promise that you're going to keep an eye out for workers in trade deals, I think you certainly could make good on that. What that actually means, I'm not quite sure. I think the promise that Hillary Clinton has made, not as much on the campaign trail as much as she has in her position papers, is bringing re-education opportunities and original education opportunities to areas that are seeing job loss. And that, to me, seems to be the area that really needs the most attention if you're going to have a community, for instance, West Virginia. Trump says we're going to bring mining back. Clinton and Sanders at the time said we're going to retrain this area. The retraining seems probably more like a viable solution, but we really have to find a model to make that work nationally.
Yeah, and Bob, let me get you to jump in real quick. We're almost out of time. Just a little bit of the local flavor on this issue with politicians.
Very similar. Governors, a lot of them say we need jobs, which is what you need to say, even though I don't believe that is the crucial thing in New Hampshire. But they all also say that we need advanced manufacturing, which isn't often a lot of jobs, but it is good paying jobs. And we need workers. We need the training. We need to keep people here. That's pretty universal among both parties. There's people saying we're not doing enough or whatever. But the idea that we need a pipeline from the high schools, from the community colleges, from the colleges into manufacturing, more advanced manufacturing, almost every candidate. That shows what a good job the BIA has done in pushing advanced manufacturing.
Well, we are unfortunately, we're out of time, and I encourage listeners to go to nhpr.org, check out the shows we've done this week on sort of the politics of the campaign and of the state. You can find those on the Exchange website. Also, check out the interactive features on trade. I'd like to thank all of my guests, Andrew McGill of The Atlantic, John Olson of Whelan Engineering, Jim Roach of the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association, and Bob Sanders at the New York Business Review. Thank you all so much for what was a really interesting and lively conversation this morning. And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.